Well, the second volume of Mark Twain's autobiography comes out this month, 16 pages longer than the 760-page first volume. It contains the humor and ire you'd expect from the writer, and we'll talk with one of the editors of the book just a little bit later on this hour. But first, if you're like me, you've heard the story that Samuel Clemens adopted the pen name Mark Twain from his days as a riverboat captain. Maybe you're familiar with the lesser-known tale of Clemens using the name for a running bar tab at John Piper's Saloon in Virginia City, Nevada. Turns out both of those stories were debunked a long time ago, leaving Twainians wondering where and when did Samuel Clemens find the nom de plume Mark Twain. Joining us now is Kevin McDonald. He's a proprietor of McDonald Rare Books in Austin, Texas. His 30 years of experience in the rare book field includes work as a university rare book librarian, published bibliographer, appraiser, and library consultant. Last year, his article, How Samuel Clemens Found Mark Twain in Carson City, was published in the Mark Twain Journal. He joins us by telephone now from Austin. Kevin, thanks for taking time with us today. Nice to have you.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, Samuel Clemens had employed numerous pen names before settling on Mark Twain. What were some of the more colorful ones?
He used the name eponymous, I think it was W. eponymous or E. eponymous Blab. he used another one, Snodgrass. He had a long list of names that he employed at different times, Dog Bedeviled Citizen, which he borrowed from his brother. he just had one after another, but none of them that he stuck with. The Snodgrass letters, I think he wrote half a dozen letters with that name, but the other ones he would use once or twice, and then he'd move on to another one the next time he published a letter or put something in local newspaper.
Kevin, why was he so intent on not using his given name? Was that just merely the fashion of the times or among writers, or why did he do it that way?
It created a persona, and it was a fashion of the times. A lot of people were using pen names at that time. There was a group of authors who were mostly comic writers, and they were mostly newspapermen, and they were called the Funny Fellows. They spelled it P-H-U-N-N-Y-P-H-E-L-L-O-W, the Funny Fellows. And they indulged in a lot of slapstick humor and misspelled words and bad grammar. And Twain was, at that time in his career in the 1850s, he was imitating the Funny Fellows.
Kevin, you were researching a separate project several years ago looking for publications in which the name Mark Twain appeared. At one point, your search focused on use of his other pen names prior to 1863 in the humor magazines of the day when, as you write, gold was struck. What did you find, and where did you find it?
Well, I had been looking for first printings by Mark Twain. I was looking for actual writings by Mark Twain, and I was looking in books and journals and things using Google Books, which back then I think was called the Google Print Library or Google Library Project or something. This is about 2006 or 7, and they had just announced that they were adding the contents of the New York Public Library to their Google Books, and I got very excited and thought, well, there's a gold mine. And I started looking at things, but the number of hits that I was getting quickly grew. I would get hundreds of hits, then thousands, then tens of thousands, and if you go back to Google Books now, you'll get hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And I would do it year by year, and when I gave up on that project, I started looking for his use of his earlier pen names in newspapers, books, and any place else I could find them online, looking by date, and then I started looking by the name of the comic journals, of which there were about two dozen, three dozen of them. And so I would look for Mark Twain and then three dozen different journals in a year, and then I would change the year, go to the next year. And that way I kept my search results small, and it was a tedious project, but I eventually got to the combination of looking for Mark Twain and put in the magazine Vanity Fair and plugged in the year 1861, and that's when I found an article in Vanity Fair, not written by Mark Twain, but just using the name Mark Twain for the first time anywhere as a proper name.
Yeah, tell us a little bit
about
that.
I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that sketch in Vanity Fair. I mean, what was the title, and what was the whole thing about?
It's called The North Star, and it was written at the beginning of the Civil War. It was written in January of 1861, just before the war broke out. And the gist of the article is that these mariners, southern mariners, are very upset that the compasses always point north, and they thought that their compasses were being unpatriotic to the south. And they held a convention to decide what to do about this very serious problem. And they were given names by the anonymous person who wrote this little burlesque piece, and they had names like Mr. Pine Knot, Mr. Bobstay, Mr. Lee Scupper, and Mr. Mark Twain. And these were all nautical terms, but they all applied to nautical terms used on the ocean, not on the Mississippi River.
And the character was named Mark Twain just for that reason then?
Yeah, because if you were in an ocean-going vessel, the Lee Scuppers, the leeward or leeward, it was pronounced leeward by sailors, leeward scuppers were the drain holes on the side of the ship where sewage and blood and fish guts and things like that would be washed off a deck. And if pine knots were used to light torches, a bobstay was a piece of rigging that held the bowsprit, the front pole on the ship that comes out. And these were all sailing vessels. And Mr. Ratlin, the rat lines that sailors used to climb up and down to the masts. And Mark Twain, of course, for an ocean-going vessel, meant 2 fathoms, just like it does on the Mississippi River. But it didn't mean safe water or dangerous water. It just meant shallow water, because these were big ships that would draft about 15 to 25 feet, unlike a steamboat on the Mississippi River that would draft only 3 to 10 feet.
We're visiting with Kevin McDonald, proprietor of McDonald Rare Books in Austin, Texas, about how Mark Twain came to get that name, Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens' name that he used for himself for so many years. So it was possible then that Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, didn't see the Vanity Fair sketch when it was first published, right?
Entirely possible. He was busy trying to evade conscription into the Union Army. All the Mississippi River pilots were thrown out of work when the blockade was put up, and there was actually a cannon shot across the bow of the ship that Twain was on that broke the glass in the pilot house, and he ignored the first shot, but the second shot, the pilot of that ship, I don't think Twain was actually the pilot, but he was present, and they got the message that they should stop, and all of these pilots were thrown out of work, and then the Union Army was trying to round up pilots to pilot military boats and convert all of the civilian craft on the river, keelboats, steamboats, any other boats on the river, to military use. And Twain hid out with his family in St. Louis, trying not to be found. He made himself unavailable for that. So he may have read it then, he may not have, but he was also at that time not seeking fame and fortune as a writer. Mm-hmm. His occupation was river pilot. He was paid $250 a month, which was an enormous sum of money back then. Average person was making $50 or $60 a month by comparison. So he had no intention of being a writer. He had published things in newspapers, never made any money. He was wishing that he could become a pilot and stay a pilot.
Huh. And you say it's most likely then that Clemens saw the sketch and the name Mark Twain. It wasn't until 1862 or 1863 when he was out in Nevada. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and that probably is going to be, that sounds strange to most listeners who are not familiar with the system that was used in American newspapers in the 19th century, where newspapers, by congressional act, were allowed to send copies of their papers to other papers, and this also included magazines. They could send through, it was called the exchange system, and without paying any postage at all, they could send one copy of their paper, exchange it with any other newspaper, and most papers exchanged with hundreds of newspapers, and by around 1860, most of them were exchanging with 1,000 or more papers. Hmm. So anything published in New York would find its way across the country to other newspapers pretty quickly, and I actually researched particular newspapers in California who were exchanging with Nevada newspapers, and I researched Nevada newspapers that were exchanging with New York papers and found that Vanity Fair was, in 1861, routinely being reprinted in part in those California papers with which and Nevada papers in which Twain was familiar.
So when did Samuel Clemens first use the nom de plume Mark Twain?
He and a friend of his named Clement Rice had a kind of a hoax going. They were working for rival newspapers in Virginia City, Nevada, and Clement Rice nicknamed Twain the reliable, and Twain nicknamed Clement Rice the unreliable, and they had this mock feud going on. Hmm. And Twain went to Carson City at the end of January in 1863, and from Carson City he wrote an account of a party that he attended where he claimed to have run into Clement Rice, and he wrote this humorous letter and signed it Mark Twain, right out of the blue. For some reason, going to Carson City within just 2 or 3 days, He writes this letter, and he chooses Mark Twain.
Wow. And he was really never very clear as to why he began using the name, right?
No, it was only the second time that the words or the term Mark Twain had ever been used in print as a proper name. The first time was in Vanity Fair, and the second time was in that letter from Carson City. And he didn't explain it at the time. He didn't come up with an explanation for about 10 years.
And what did he say then?
Well, there was a rumor going around in some Nevada papers that he was using, that it was came from a bar tab where he would tell the bartender to Mark Twain, mark two drinks. And, of course, Mark Twain's friends would say, well, he never bought drinks for anybody. He was cheap, and he was very good at avoiding paying the rent and very good at being a freeloader. But the people who were circulating these stories tended to be people who didn't know Twain, had never met Twain, and they were claiming that these things took place in places that didn't exist. One said it happened in a brewery in some little town in Nevada that happened not to have a brewery. And so Twain caught wind of those stories and wrote a letter disavowing them and then offering as an alternative that he got the story, told the story that he stole the name from Captain Sellers, Isaiah Sellers, an old Mississippi steamboat pilot who had recently died. And that, of course, has now been disproven.
Disproven, too. Well, Kevin McDonald owns McDonald's Rare Books in Austin, Texas. He's the author of How Samuel Clemens Found Mark Twain in Carson City, published last year in the Mark Twain Journal. Kevin, you were great. Thanks for taking a few minutes and telling us a great tale there. I appreciate it.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Well, in a 1904 letter to a friend, Mark Twain wrote this: "You will never know how much enjoyment you have lost until you get to go about dictating your autobiography." Well, Twain must have regained a lot of that enjoyment as the second volume of his autobiography is being released this month. Joining us now from his offices of the Mark Twain Papers and Writers Project at the University of California, Berkeley, is one of the co-editors of this massive autobiography. His name is Ben Griffin, and Ben, welcome to Up to Date. It's so nice to have you.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be talking to you.
So volumes one and two are each over 700 pages. Is there a volume three to come, or is this it?
No, volume three is to come. Yes, it's well in hand, and we're editing it right now.
And will it also be in the 700-page range?
Yes, it will.
How does volume one differ from volume two, Ben? What are the distinctions?
Well, it's all part of one big sprawling autobiography, and the division into volumes is based on bulk, you know, word count, basically, not theme or anything like that. But I would say that volume one, he was very much into the new process of dictating the autobiography that he had just hit upon, and is dictating very enthusiastically, and he goes into his early life and tells some of stories he had told many times for the most part, but he tells them very well here. In volume two, by that time, he's run through a lot of his set pieces about his early life in Hannibal, Missouri, and his time on the river and his time out west. And so in volume two, you start to read more about his daily life in 1906-07, what concerns him at the moment, his current fads and crazes, his political concerns, and his daily irritations and joys.
Well, speaking of daily irritations, one of the things that's included in volume two is Mark Twain's, Samuel Clemens' struggles with houseflies. There's a link to one of those stories on your website right now, Ben. Tell us a little bit about that story, because he really struggles with the housefly and sort of acknowledges the housefly is the ruler of his domain.
Yeah, of everybody's domain.
Yeah.
He thinks the house. He proves, I think, very eloquently that basically what he's trying to do is puncture mankind's vanity in himself. You know, what he says, well, you know, we think so well of ourselves. Of course, this was the early 20th century, and skyscrapers and railroads and you know, progress of various kinds. We think so well of ourselves, but the housefly hasn't changed. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Housefly hasn't changed for millions of years, and it lives in our houses, and we can't do a thing about it, and it doesn't pay us a dime.
It's a great piece.
It's a beautiful piece.
I chuckled out loud three or four times as I was going through it. How many editors do you have working on volume two? How many folks worked on that thing, Ben?
There's two principal editors, myself and Harriet Smith, and then there's also four associate editors. So it's a sizable team for a sizable book.
Yeah, I was going to say, what were you working off of? I mean, what was your job? What did your job entail?
Every aspect of production of a book, from starting with it as a big pile of typescripts and manuscripts that are revised and much revised and reduplicated and fragmentary sometimes, editing, establishing the text, which means comparing them, making sure you've established which are the latest revisions, the latest manuscripts, and getting them together. Oh, sorry?
Ben, just slow down for a second. So you were working off of what? I mean, pages of dictation that Twain had gone through and edited?
Right. He dictated to the secretary. She took it down in shorthand. Later, she expanded her shorthand into a typed document. These were turned over to Clemens, and he revised them and passed them back to her for retyping, usually. And that's where matters basically stood during his lifetime, except for the pieces of it, a few select pieces of it, that he approved to go into a magazine.
So you were actually working off of these typewritten pages dating from when? The early part of the last century then, right?
Dating from 1904 through 1909 total. Yeah.
And where are those pages kept today? Because those must be regarded as great treasures even now.
Well, they are. They're priceless. They're kept in our vault.
Mm-hmm.
We have a vault.
And what do you make of the writing process as you look at the first copy versus the revised copies later on? What do you glean from the way Twain wrote and how he approached the editing of his autobiography?
What makes it sometimes difficult and curious for us as editors is that on the one hand, he's writing this book to say, as he says numerous times in the book, I'm going to have this book published after my death, so 100 years after my death, so that I can be totally frank about everyone I know and about myself, frank and uncomplimentary. And on the other hand, he is also thinking of publishing. It's evident here and there that he's made revisions that are designed to suppress people's identities, that are designed to take some of his, to modify some of his most cruel expressions. And so the book's character is a little difficult to understand, which sometimes affects our editing.
Because maybe he didn't want to wait 100 years. He was going back and forth on that critical idea then.
He definitely didn't want to wait 100 years to see some of it appear, the parts of it that he thought would pass muster in the public sphere.
Like which parts?
Oh, a lot of the reminiscences of, like I said, about Hannibal, his youth, about piloting on the river, about his time in Nevada. He published quite a lot of that. He published quite a lot of the material that's about his daughter, Susie.
Mm-hmm.
These appeared in the North American Review in 1906-07. Beautiful things about reminiscences of Susie as a child and portions of a book that she wrote about him, portions of a biography she wrote of her father.
Does he talk about the writing process of his great classics like Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer?
He does. He talks about them with greater and lesser accuracy. He claims that at one point in Volume 2 that he was the first person to have the typewriting machine, as he calls it, used to produce a novel. He thinks it was Tom Sawyer that he had typed,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't. Hmm. It was Life on the Mississippi.
Hmm.
It shows the value of annotation. I think we've got a note at the back. If you care about whether he's right or wrong about these things, we've got a note at the back of the book explaining that his calculating is a little off.
Well, why does the University of California at Berkeley have this project to begin with? I mean, how did you guys come across it?
Well, it was I didn't come across it. It was it was already a possession of the University of California when I was born. It was in 1949 that this collection of papers was acquired by the Regents of UC. It was a gift of Clara Clemens, who was the only surviving child of Mark Twain. She was convinced to donate the papers to Berkeley over the rival claims of Yale, which she had been planning to give them to. So,
why did California beat out Yale?
Persistence, I think.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I wasn't very close to this process, which is, to me, somewhat shrouded in mystery. But one thing is clear. There they are. Basically, what I think happened is that they were, at first, these papers were a private possession, and they were given to, they were the legacy of the Mark Twain estate, and they were given to his official executor.
Mm-hmm.
The executor eventually gave them to someone else who was working on them at Harvard, and then he was relieved of his duties, and the papers were given to somebody who was a professor at UCLA. Who was then offered a job at Berkeley and brought the papers and the project with him.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was he died in 1950, I think it was. And from that time, the papers have been in the possession of University of California.
Are the personalities of Samuel Clemens and Mark Twain, are they one and the same or are they distinct?
People differ about that. I don't think they're distinct. I think Mark Twain is a name that he uses when he's writing. I don't really believe it's a dramaturgical attempt to create a person who is fundamentally different from himself. Although I will admit that using a different name gives you freedom to say things that you might not have said in your own person.
Well, Volume 3 is still to come. When do you see that thing coming online and being published, Ben? What's the date there?
Yeah, and it will literally be online because we are putting all of these books up online at Mark Twain Project Online, where they are freely accessible. Volume 2 will be there in short order. Volume 1 is already there, and Volume 3 will, of course, be there when it's done. I think it's going to be 2015 when Volume 3 comes out.
And these things are fun to read, I gather. This is not scholarly stuff. This is a pretty breezy read, I gather.
Yeah, breezy. Yeah, that's the word. Mark Twain is always lively.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you for taking some time. Ben Griffin is co-editor of the Mark Twain Papers and Project at the University of California, Berkeley. Interesting stuff from one of our own here from Missouri, Ben. Thank you for taking some time.
Well, thank you.
You bet. You can find more information about all our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can get a behind-the-scenes look at our program. Just follow me, at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, we'll get a look at the man behind Prairie Home Companion and maybe exchange a tale or two about good old Minnesota with Garrison Keillor. He'll be on the show with us tomorrow. He'll be in town next week as well. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.